Ohio issues a statewide quarantine for the invasive spotted lanternfly and expands its quarantine for box tree moths. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our monthly gardening show, we'll ask our experts what's up with these flying interlopers and what impact they're having on our gardens. And of course, we'll be taking your questions for the full hour. Joining me now are Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher, Civic Garden Center Director of Education Mary Dudley, and last but not least, Assistant Entomology Professor at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs. Welcome back, everybody.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, it almost feels like spring. I mean, we're talking gardening. Let's hope the weather catches up with us. If you've got questions for our experts, and we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So, Joe, Ohio made this quarantine for spotted lanternfly statewide. It expanded the quarantine for box tree moth. What is going on with these bugs?
Well, they're both non-natives, and they're just tracking like non-natives do. You know, when we have these non-natives arrive at our shore, you know, for a short period of time, we hardly notice them. I mean, that's, you know, they're just in the background, maybe not discovered for a while. And then, of course, as time goes on, depending on, you know, the host, depending on the population dynamics of the insect, they can explode. And that explosion also happens laterally, meaning that, okay, as they move forward. For example, Lucy, I always use this as an example, Japanese beetles. At one time, they were apocalyptic in greater Cincinnati, right? But what are they doing now? Well, if you go further out west, you do see high populations. Here, you see much lower populations. They've equilibrated with nature. So now we're dealing with something brand new. With spotted lanternfly, for example, everything is pointing towards that happening eventually. It's already happened in the eastern United States. In Pennsylvania, we see much lower populations than we saw originally. But we're at the front edge. And so we're going to experience some years where we're going to see very high numbers. Now, they will primarily be a nuisance pest, but I'm sure John will also weigh in. They are a sucking insect. And they like maples. They not only like Tree of Heaven, but they also like maples. So we're also cautioning folks that if they do arrive in large numbers and you have a newly planted maple, you may want to do something about it. And also, if you have maples that are in a place where they're stressed, there may be a greater impact. But eventually, you know, they will move on. Box tree moth is a little different. It has a single host. And so we'll only find them on boxwoods. But even there, we have two things happening at the same time. First, there's a lot of research being done by Dr. Teresa Culley at UC, who has identified and done DNA testing to further identify boxwoods that are resistant. So eventually we'll have those to plant in our landscape. The second thing, though, is that we're learning how to live with them. We're learning that they can be managed. They're actually fairly easy to, they're easy to kill. Spinosad, for example, is a biorational, so it doesn't kill everything else. It's highly effective on this insect. So it's just, we're just loosely kind of suffering through, you know, the beginnings as we move hopefully towards the end.
So, John, what kind of problems have these pests been causing for people with their shrubs and trees and landscapes, the spotted lanternfly and the box tree moths? What are you hearing from people?
So right now, the spotted lanternfly, we've definitely seen it on individual trees here and there, but I haven't seen it take over and be a problem like it has been in other places in the country yet. And I think it's just a matter of time before that really kicks in. And like Joe said, when people are having problems with specific trees, there are treatment options available to control it, but you're not going to control a woods or you're not going to control some widespread huge area easily. And then as far as the boxwoods go, you know, that's been pretty devastating last year, and a lot of people lost a lot of, you know, what they would consider valuable landscape and cost people a lot of money to replace shrubs and treat and do all the things that keep their yards looking nice. So it's been a big deal.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to a question, an email that we got from one of our listeners, Maureen. She has two questions. One of them is about boxwoods. She wants to know, what is that on one of my 6 boxwoods? She sent a couple of photos that show some yellowing leaves. Some of the leaves almost look kind of pinkish brown in these photos, too. What do you think, John?
Well, it's all out on the tips, and so I don't see any bug issue. We were kind of talking about it amongst the group beforehand, and I still think there's a reasonable chance there's a little bit of winter burn involved or some kind of stem cracking from the ice or snow. But it doesn't look like something I'd panic about. I'd trim it out and move on and see how the plant responds.
Okay. Now, Joe, you had a different opinion before the show than John. You thought maybe it didn't look like winter burn to you.
Well, of course, we're going to have differences of opinion, right, John? I mean, that's what we're here for.
Absolutely.
So just a description for the audience is these are very dark green boxwoods. They actually look pretty good. And here and there at the tips, you know, here and there, nothing that is solid. You don't have an entire side of the plant that is showing this. You have these, you know, brownish tips. And so, you know, we were scratching our heads. I do think, John, you know, you could have a point there, maybe snow load, maybe something has caused branch breakage. That happens. We tend to forget about that. Though, Mary, I have to say that you proposed something I really liked, and that's the idea that depending on where these boxwoods are located, and I don't think that she said an email, did she? I looked and I didn't think
she,
I saw.
Yep, she did not. She did not say where she lives.
Well, if these boxwoods are over towards Claremont County and points east, Mary proposed that this might be leftover cicada damage, periodical cicada oviposition damage. They lay their eggs in stems, and that eventually can kill the stem, and then we get dieback. And that's going to be with us for this entire season. We're going to see flagging. We call it flagging. It looks like somebody's tied, you know, the tape, you know, that we use for surveying, flagging tape. And that's going to be with us, and we're just going to have to expect these random, you know, stems turning brown on both big trees, and the cicadas will lay eggs down on shrubs. So I thought, Mary, you really came up with a very good point that not only applies to this, but everyone needs to be aware of this if you're kind of east of Cincinnati.
Yeah, Mary, what made you think of this? Was it the random nature of the stuff?
Well, first, just let me bask in the glow of a compliment from
yes,
Joe Boggs.
Yes.
I'm just going to
say, oh, now, wait a minute. Okay, all
put
right.
Put that in my pocket.
It's only $10 worth. That was just a $10 compliment. I know.
But I am out there pruning orchard trees now, and we see this type of damage coming on a lot of our thinner branches, and it really does look like something tried to get in there and open it up. There's flaking, and so some of our branches have die-off, and you want to be paying attention to that now. It's a really great time to prune orchard trees and paying attention to what tips you should be pruning out, especially if you're seeing that dieback. So that was what brought it to mind.
Mm. Well, speaking of great
observation.
Yeah. Speaking of pruning, Maureen's other question is, when should I prune my Rose of Sharon?
Now's a great time. Any time in the winter. So Rose of Sharon bloom on new season's growth. So when they start growing in the spring, at some point they're going to develop the buds that are going to flower. So if you cut it when it's dormant, you won't damage any of the flowers for this summer.
Okay.
Well, again, hey, John, just a very quick question. Is it a good time to prune oaks?
Well, it's a great time to prune oaks. Yes.
Was that a setup?
Oh, there's
certainly the concern for oak wilt in our area, and it hasn't been spreading. It hasn't been a big deal. It hasn't taken over like it has other places in the country. But us taking precautions to prune oaks in the winter is the reasonable thing to do to prevent this thing from taking off if it does show up, because the bug spreads it that has the fungus on it, the picnic beetles. And then if you prune in the winter, the picnic beetle's not flying, so you really reduce the chances of spreading oak wilt by doing dormant season oak pruning. So thank you, Joe.
Sorry, Lucy, I couldn't help that. I mean, John set that up before.
That was great. That was that was some impressive gardening show teamwork. I appreciate it. We are talking about gardening for the full hour today, and if you've got questions for our experts, give us a call at 513 513- 419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. I want to talk a little bit more about these box tree moths because, you know, John, you mentioned that a lot of people lost a lot of boxwoods last year. I think this first appeared in 2023 near the border of Claremont and Hamilton County. So it's been around for a while, but it's sort of spreading, having a lot of impact on people. How tough is it to spot these moths before they totally destroy your boxwoods, John?
Well, they can be really quick. And when you go on vacation for a couple of weeks and come home, your plants could be completely denuded of leaves. It's amazing how fast that happens. But what's happening in the background is they're there and they're growing and they're getting bigger. And then I think just all of a sudden, once they're big enough to have this voracious appetite, that's when you go out of town and you come home and it's like, poof, they're gone. But really, if you see them starting to thin out and you see the even mostly defoliated boxwoods, if you treat them, the boxwoods will come back in most cases. And it's the ones that are just left for the bugs to eat and eat and eat on that I'm seeing there's no viability left in the stem. Mm. So I think in most of the ones that I've seen that have even been beaten up pretty bad are still capable of coming back if you give them time.
Joe, you
Lucy, were- I want to – let me just inject something here because this is – the timing is really good for this show. Box tree moths overwinter only as early caterpillars. They don't overwinter as eggs or adults or pupae. So right now they're in these little structures we call a hibernaculum. They're in a state of physiological stasis that we call diapause. If we brought them inside and warmed them up, they wouldn't start becoming active again. It takes a day length to break that. So sometime in probably early April to mid-April, these little caterpillars will, what we call break diapause, they'll come out, they'll start feeding, they feed voraciously. And that is the one time during the season that everything synchronized, everything is in the same stage. We have at least three generations. And so if we let those caterpillars go, they will pupate, they will become adults, and then they'll lay eggs, and we get the first full generation, and then everything happens over again, just keeps repeating. But the problem is that as the season progresses, they become less synchronous in their development. So you'll have eggs, you'll have pupae, you'll have caterpillars. And what John said is entirely true. If you wait and spray late, you may not get all the stages. And then again, you know, we just see a very quick rise. So it's very important if people are trying to manage this to make that early spring or that spring application. And we're seeing in some situations where we're at the edge of the infestation, so we don't have a lot of adults flying, that single application can avoid multiple applications through the season. So this program's timing is very good. And I really appreciate that it's entirely dedicated to box tree moths. Lucy, I can't thank you enough.
Well, maybe not entirely dedicated, but Joe, I just want to check with you because you are usually such a defender of the insects, but it sounds like I'm hearing from Joe Boggs that it is okay to kill box tree moths and it is okay to kill spotted lantern flies. Can we just kill those?
You're breaking up, Lucy. I can't really hear you very well.
Now, I've got a question too, Joe. I know you're talking about, we're talking about sprays and we're talking about treatment, but for ongoing, you know, would it be beneficial to be attracting a certain species of bird or something else to your yard that can help manage these critters at different life stages? Is there a biological or an integrated pest management strategy we can use?
Okay, so now I have to send you the $10. seriously, you brought up a very good point, and I'll try to make this very quick. You're onto something that we teach about quite a lot. And it is, yes, we hope that people will attract. Now, I'm going to go over pollinators, because many pollinators are also enemies of other insects. For example, all of the parasitoid wasps, every parasitoid wasp out there, the females must have nectar. So if we plant flowering plants, we plant things, you know, with the intention of attracting pollinators, we will also attract these enemies of other insects. And the place to see this in real life is at the Cincinnati Botanical Garden and Zoo. That's how I did it. Because we see very few pests there. And it's because they have such a diversity of flowering plants. So Mary, you're on to something. And that doesn't just apply to box tree moth. That applies to things like bagworms. Two papers published, one in 1976, the other in 2020, showed clearly that if we have a large abundance of flowering plants that then attracts a couple of parasitoid wasps that are enemies of bagworms, you won't need to spray for bagworms. They suppress the population. So it's something that is really singing the praise of looking at landscape ecosystems rather than just landscapes as standalone entities. And it takes time, but that's what we like to see people do. And I mentioned spinosad, for example, and that is an insecticide. I mean, box tree moth caterpillars are easy to kill with a lot of different insecticides. But if you chose something that we call birational, like spinosad, it does not kill the beneficial insects. It's fairly narrow targeted. And so that's the other thing that we hope people consider doing.
Okay, well, we are starting to get lots of questions from our listeners. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with our gardening show very soon and answer some of these questions. This is Cincinnati Edition. You can donate to the station right now online at wvxu.org. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show, and our experts are here to answer your questions. Today, I'm joined by Civic Garden Center Director of Education, Mary Dudley, Assistant Entomology Professor at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO, John Butcher. We know you've got questions for them, so give us a call at 513-419-7100. Or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So, John, when we were talking about bugs, we got some questions about some other things. We got a call from Ginger who asks, how can she properly plant a red maple tree on her property? What's your advice, John?
So with all trees, the first thing you're going to want to do is identify the root flare or trunk flare, which is the spot as the tree goes into the ground. You see it get uniformly wider and spread out, kind of like where you see like a trunk touching the ground, and you see like almost like fingers coming off of the side of the trunk. So that's going to be your root flare. You're going to want to plant that to match the existing grade of the yard in most cases, unless you have a really swampy area. But red maples can even take a little bit of wet, so that's not such an issue with red maples. The big issue with red maples is that they have a lot of girdling roots, which are roots that wrap themselves around the trunk of the tree and actually strangle it long term. Short term, no big deal. Long term, it ends up causing a much shortened life. So what you want to do is once you get the tree set and at the right height, you want to pull the soil back, the burlap back, whatever it is that's covering up those roots and expose them, and actually make some cuts to eliminate the roots that are cutting across the trunk and will potentially choke out the tree long term. There's also other things like planting, you know, digging the hole twice as wide as the width. You want the depth just the right depth. And there's more intricacies depending on what style of plant you have to go with. But those are the main things. If you get the trunk flare and the girdling roots right, you'll have a lot of luck.
Okay. I hope that helps, Ginger. We also got a question from Catherine who asks, when should I cut back the bushes in my butterfly pollinator garden? Mary, what do you think?
Well, we want to keep those stems intact until a lot of our insects have emerged from their winter store time, their little dormancy time. And so really mid to late March is what we're looking at. So I know that it's warm today and we had a warm day last week and people are out there cutting things. And, you know, if you want to get into your garden and do some things, you can take care of your tools. You could tap a maple tree. We're processing sap right now. But I would wait to do those cutbacks for about another month.
Yeah, you don't want to evict your pollinators right
now. That's right. Okay. We want to wait till they all come out.
Okay. Well, we have a caller on the line. Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Hi, yes. I'm calling for my daughter. They just removed a trampoline from their backyard, and so there's no grass there. There are lots and lots of roots from copious maple trees that are along their fence line. They want to be able to put a swing there, and they got different opinions about ruining the tree or killing the tree because the roots are above surface.
Mm. So she's trying to figure out how to kind of flatten that area for a swing without hurting her trees?
Yes, yes. Okay. Does that really kill the tree?
So I can help a little bit. Certainly you can kill the tree if you, you know, depending on how close the roots are to the trunk, how big the tree is, how much damage you're planning to do. But a general rule of thumb, if we took the diameter of the trunk, which would be measured at 54 inches above ground level, so let's just assume it's a 3-foot diameter tree, a really big tree, we would want to cut roots absolutely no closer than 9 foot away from that. So 3 times the diameter would be the absolute minimum I would look at before I would start wholesale cutting roots on one side of a tree. I would prefer to see 5 times or more. So more like 15 feet is an ideal thing. But outside of that 15-foot range, if you're just making one cut on one side of the tree, a healthy tree can handle that pretty well most of the time. It doesn't mean it's a good idea or you're not hurting the tree at all, but you may be sustainable. If you get inside the 3 times the diameter range, it's really a bad idea and I wouldn't even consider it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thank you for the question.
Sure thing. Thanks for calling, Mary, and thanks for listening. Okay, we have a question from Mark. When is it the best time to prune hydrangeas and wisteria? What do you think, Joe?
Well, I think I'm going to pass this to Mary and John, but I really do. I want to say something very quickly. You know, first of all, I really do hope listeners, you know, pay attention to the fund drive, Lucy, because, you know, all three of us listen to WVXU. It's very important to us. And this, you know, the gardening show that we're doing, and you do these with a lot of different folks and you get a lot of great information. But on a personal note, I love Science Friday. So I know that that's not what we're doing on here, but I think mentioning the fund drive is important, I think, to all three of us, Lucy. So, and now I'll pass the buck. That's what I'm here for.
You're asking for bucks and now passing the buck. So I appreciate
that's exactly
it.
Right.
You have thoughts, John?
Well, let's dive into hydrangeas. So the hydrangeas that we do want to prune now are going to be your panicled hydrangeas, which are like lime white's a really popular variety of that. But they can be cut back as hard as you want to cut them back this time of year, and they'll still bloom next year. And then the Annabelle type, which are the Incredible, is like one of the more popular ones that people are selling now. But those can be cut back really hard now, and they'll still bloom full next year. The Macrophylla type, which are the big leaf ones that turn pink or blue, where you've got to add the acidity to get the blue flower, those you have to be really careful with. And you really, if you cut them all back hard at any time of the year, you may lose a bunch of blooms because most of them bloom the best on old wood, even though some of the newer varieties bloom on new season's growth. So what a lot of recommendation there is to maybe thin out 1/3 of the plant at a time rather than do all of that. And that would be like a mid to late summer thing. And then oak leaf hydrangeas are in a similar category, although I really haven't had a lot of problems with oak leaves blooming. And I know there's a lot of sensitivity on the internet about that if you look into it, but I think you can be a little more aggressive with pruning oak leaf hydrangeas after they bloom in the mid to late summer and still get blooms the next year.
Okay. What and about wisteria?
Torch it, cut it down.
Is it American wisteria? Let's just see what we're dealing with. But
honestly, a lot of people have trouble getting wisteria to bloom with or without pruning. They're like, what can we do? And I think wisteria, I can't even recall now. Does that come out? I think that's going to be a spring bloomer, which means if you're cutting back hard now, you're going to cut off your spring bloom. So if you're going to do a hard cutback, you probably want to do it after that one blooms in the late spring, early summer.
Okay. All right. Well, we got an email from Kai who asks, I am looking for plant recommendations for 4 19-gallon containers. These will be placed on a patio with southern exposure, so they will get significant sunlight. I'm interested in long-term plantings that can provide both privacy and color. Could you please suggest some options that would thrive in these conditions? Mary, I'll start with you. Do you have any thoughts for Kai?
My first thoughts are that, you know, just depending on the container, and it sounds like you've got pretty good depth, pretty size, good containers, they're going to be a little bit heavy. So you're going to want to plant something that can handle the winter chill, but that's very difficult. A lot of people that are planting in containers want to bring those in some way, or maybe even just protect them in a garage or an area, just because if we get really significant cold snaps, that soil can freeze and really damage those plants. So unless you're going to be able to move them or they're on wheels or something like that, you've just got to be really careful to pick something that's going to be able to handle those temperature swings. But I was opting for food. I was like, ooh, I know we love perennials, but, you know, some of these really fun little patio tomato varieties are really great. You can get some cool cucumbers in there, but I'll let the tree expert talk about woodies.
So this is a really tough question without more information, because I can't, like, how much privacy do you need? How tall do these plants need to get? The container, one of the things that you really want to do if we're talking about overwintering long term is make sure that there is a large soil volume, and it is, if you insulate the sides of it with whatever kind of insulation you pick. Some people use bubble wrap, and you got to make sure it's still draining out of the bottom, but on the sides. But you can do different things to keep it from getting so cold in the winter. And that really helps. But plants that I would use, if they want a taller evergreen screen and something a little more narrow, there's like in the most boring plant in the world, but an emerald green arborvitae may actually work really well for there. I actually think this is a great opportunity to consider something a little more interesting that's often faux pas is bamboo, because you're planting it in a container and it doesn't spread by seed, and you know it's not
going to honeysuckle.
Well, honeysuckle spreads by seed,
oh,
so
okay,
then
that's right.
So that's
sorry,
a different thing.
Just,
but if we've
just
got,
trying to mention another hated plant.
Well, because a lot of the bamboos are evergreen and they can be a little cold sensitive too, but I've seen them work well in container scenarios like this. There's another smaller one that I really like. But it's called a cephalotaxis or a Japanese plum yew, and there's an upright variety of that usually you can't find really big when you start. But if you're patient, that one would really grow in to be a nice upright vertical screen element to give some privacy and hold up long term. And once again, all of these plants are subject to winter damage to some degree if we get a nasty enough winter, especially in a container.
Yeah. What do you think, Joe?
I just made a note. So I think I missed some part of this, but I wrote down John recommended bamboo. Is that right, John? Is that what you're saying?
You heard it right. From,
controversial, you know, take from John Butcher.
Well, I wanted to reiterate that, because if somebody did just tune in, you know, I do think John has a very good point where you can keep. And this is, you know, I mean, I'm to the place where I just don't recommend bamboo in the ground unless you're surrounded by, you know, acres of asphalt. I mean, it's the, you know, but in containers, he makes a good point. I've seen this in a number of different commercial locations where they wanted a moving screen, meaning that they wanted to have something, but they wanted to be able to move it around. And it actually works very well. And as John said, you know, they are, most of the really large uprights are evergreen. To a point, after some years, they will go into a cycle, as they see in the native areas of China with bamboo, that where they will die out in large amount. But nonetheless, it takes quite some time for that ever to occur. But I think, you know, John stressed this. Okay, these are in containers. There's no way the bamboo doesn't produce seed. You know, the rhizomes don't jump out of the containers. It would be the one exception in terms of plant recommendations where bamboo might not be a bad idea. The concern I have for any woodies, though, I mean, you're right, John, maybe an arborvitae or you know, the cephalotaxis, is that eventually they're going to run out of room. Eventually it's going to catch up to them. So if the word long-term is in there, that's probably not going to be a woody plant.
Okay. Well, Kai, I hope that helps. We have Daniel on the line. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for listening. What are your questions?
Hi, I have two questions. One, I called a couple of years ago. I have a hill in my backyard. It's about 45 feet long, and about 15 feet deep. And I've decided to plant lavender. So I have all of these egg crates that I'm planning on using to start the seeds. I got one of those bags of 6 billion seeds. And I'm wondering, do I have to get rid of the grass first? And then I have another question. Are there any rosemary bushes that are hardy enough to live in Cincinnati?
Mary looks like she's itching to answer these questions.
Yes, I would love to be like, yeah, it's going to be great. It does sound amazing if you can get it established. But these are Mediterranean herbs that typically are used to a little bit of drier soils, a little bit less precipitation than we get in this area. And so
are you talking about the lavender or the rosemary or
both?
Okay.
And so they are a little bit of a challenge. If you have a microclimate, I'm not sure what direction your hill is facing, but they like a little bit of a longer season, and so sometimes if we get an earlier snap, that's in the winter season, that's going to be really damaging to them. I would definitely remove the sod because you're going to want less competition, probably not in a huge area, maybe just around where you're planting. I like to incorporate a little bit of a raised element and some sand into my plantings when I do herbs like that. But yeah, I would get rid of the sod, be prepared to put down some kind of cardboard or some other type of mulching to keep that weed seed bed down. And then as far as rosemary goes, I do pull that one inside for the winter. So I have not been successful in overwintering that outside.
I've had a few years of rosemary making it, and then you get a really cold winter and it's done for. One thing to consider here, if we're going in the herb direction, that could work though, would be the creeping thymes are actually, they have the nice herby smell, low ground cover, probably not as much of a show as what you're looking for on the hillside, but something that maybe you could work in for part of it that could hold up a little more reliably than the lavender.
Daniel, is your idea more about smell or appearance or both?
Yep. Both.
All of the above. Well, that would smell lovely.
Lavender is sort of an insect repellent. I'm going to replace all my mulch with creeping thyme.
Nice. Yeah, I think that you're on to something good. I would kind of start it in spots, making sure that you're not planting in any area that just stays very wet, and then taking a look at your soil and seeing if you need to make some amendments to that. They do make several types of rosemary. What kind of rosemary were you overwintering?
I have no idea.
Okay. ARP probably is one of the more common ones. So we're going to have a few different varieties at the Civic Garden Center for our Grow Fest, which is on May 2nd. So if you want to come and really get nerdy about herbs, you can come and visit us that day and see what we've got.
Be an herb nerd.
Is this full sun, this hillside?
I'm sorry?
Is it a full sun hillside?
Oh, yeah. From the minute it comes up to the minute it goes down.
This isn't an herb, but there's lots of really cool sedum varieties, S-E-D-U-M, the stone crops. And there's just so much variety in those. And they do really well on hot, dry places and create really strong ground covers, and you could have lots of diversity in that planting within that genus. So genus meaning sedum, but there's lots of different types. And I would probably try to work some of those in.
Okay. All right. I'll look into it.
Well, thanks for calling, Daniel. We really appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. We're going to be back to wrap up our gardening show after a short break. If you've got questions, now's the time to call. 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our monthly gardening show, and you still have time to get advice from our experts. My guests today are Assistant Entomology Professor at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher, and Civic Garden Center Director of Education Mary Dudley. If you have questions, they have answers. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. We did get a question from Deborah who asks, when should I have my eastern redbud pruned? It's outgrowing the space, but I want to keep it. Can ask you about that, John.
Yeah, I think it's really okay to prune whenever. Certainly it's a spring bloomer, so there's buds set now. And if you prune it right now, you're going to lose a few blooms. You might wait a month and then it'll have bloomed and you can lose no blooms at all. But if you're looking to do an aggressive cutback and be really hard on it, I would recommend doing that during the dormant season before the tree puts its energy out, and then you cut it all off. And you'll still get blooms on the red bud because they bloom a lot on the interior wood. So depending on if you want to do a light prune, maybe wait till the beginning of April, middle of April. And if you want to do a hard cutback, I would try to do it before it blooms.
Okay. And we got an email from Kevin. This one's for you, Joe. Kevin writes, is the insecticide that Joe is referring people to organic? If not, is there an organic product that can be used?
Oh, yes. And by the way, I want to go back. I gave an answer about the rosemary that was probably one of the better answers I've ever given. But unfortunately, I had muted myself. So I didn't know.
Oh, no, Joe.
It was lost to humanity.
Wow.
Yes.
Would you
Spinosad
like to?
Is, no, I was just joking. I actually was muted and didn't realize it. And I was starting to talk. And I thought, well, they're being very rude. They're not even listening to me. No, the spinosad is it's actually recognized in organic gardening. So it is a part of that whole group of insecticides that can be used if you are doing organic gardening. And it's very effective against quite a range of insects, not just caterpillars. But again, the important point is that it does not take out the non-targets that we would like to preserve so they can do their work to help with pest suppression.
Okay. Joe, do you want to say anything about rosemary? I feel so bad that you felt silenced about your rosemary thoughts.
It was somehow I know John did it. I don't know how he did it on my computer. He muted me. I don't know.
He's nodding in kind of a sneaky way.
I've been trying for years to mute you, Joe, and there's no possible way.
Well, now you and Mary are in cahoots. I know.
Well, Mary, speaking of Mary, what? We had a week earlier this month where it really did feel like spring. My guess is that got a lot of people thinking, ooh, I want to get out in that garden. What are some of the things we can be doing right now?
Yeah, so you want to be careful about trampling in your garden just because the soil can still be very wet and you can compact it and that will give you problems later on. So you want to be thinking about your seed starting, which should be something on folks' minds in the next few weeks. I'll be starting a lot of seeds. And so I'm getting out my heat mats and I'm getting out all my seed starting materials. I'm testing my lights. I'm making sure that I have the seeds that I want. And there are some great seed swaps and plant swaps that are organized all over the place. And so if you want to get in and see if you can get some interesting seeds this year, but also creating a rotation plan. So if you planted tomatoes last year, you're going to want to plant those tomatoes in a different area. Same with, you know, your beans or your cucumbers and squashes. So you want to rotate your crops. And so really looking at what area you have to work with. Are you going for containers? Are you going to be in ground? So it's all right to get that seed catalog out, start dreaming big, make your vision board, and then decide how you're going to manage your rotation plan this year. In addition to that, you know, making sure your tools are ready. That lawn mowing schedule is going to be coming up soon, and you want to be sharpening things like your chainsaw and your other tools with your flat files. So just kind of getting ready. We're doing a lot of that. Making some observations too. You know, go out there and walk around, find out which areas are soggy. Maybe you had some dieback that you noticed in the fall, and so you're like, oh, I want to make sure that I'm protecting this tree, or maybe I need to add a little bit more compost or mulch to an area. But it's still kind of in the planning zone right now.
Okay. What seeds are you starting indoors?
Oh my goodness. So last year I had a lot of fun with tomatillos, but I think that I might have maxed out my appetite for salsa verde. So we're going back to cherry tomatoes. And so I'm just looking through all these beautiful catalogs and thinking about all the different cherry tomatoes. So I'll be doing tomatoes. I love hot peppers. And sometimes those can be hard to find. So I'll be starting hot peppers. Cucumbers are always a classic, and we want to get those early so that we can start to make our pickles. So that's what I'll be starting with.
Okay.
You know, I want to pick up on something. So you do so well with tomatillas. You have to use a chainsaw? I heard you talk about sharpening a chainsaw. Wow.
Pretty much. They really go for it.
Well, we have Michelle on the line. Hey, Michelle, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for this great show today. I seem to have a backyard full of grubs. We've lived here about 30 years. We have limited treatment of pesticides in the back, do some fertilizing, overseeding, aeration every few years. But the only thing that's different is a number of years ago, maybe three, four years ago, a neighbor put out mole traps, the type that have the sound that radiates out that, you know, drives the moles away. And I'm wondering if that impacted the grubs in our lawn. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's kind of, you see the half of the area of the backyard is dead. You go back and pull up the grass, kind of like a toupee off someone's head. And you can see just the dead grass being pulled up and all the grubs underneath. Just wondering, best way to treat with all of your expertise, not just what I'm reading online.
Joe, I'm going to turn to you. Are you pro-grub?
Pro, yes, I just
well,
love
it. Well, that's part of it, too,
Well, okay, so let's disconnect moles from grubs, because moles primarily feed on earthworms. I'm not saying you don't have grubs. So the moles are not entirely connected, but the fact that you have grubs, now that's interesting. So, is this in full sun? Let me start there.
Yes, it's in full sun. Always has been. We had some ash trees, you know, when we first moved in 30 years ago.
Yeah.
That, of course, has since been taken down. But yeah, pretty much all full sun.
Okay, so let's hold on any idea of a grub, you know, insecticide application. And let's start with what they're eating. Most of our white grubs feed on decaying organic matter. That includes Japanese beetle grubs, which we don't see as much now, but the Schaefer's, for example, the larvae, the grubs feed primarily on decaying organic matter. People think they're root feeders. Hmm. They just shear roots. So if your lawn has been there
anything,
a while.
Joe, do they hurt anything, the grubs?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, as they shear the roots of the turf grass, that's where you get this toupee effect, which I really, you know, this is why I have a face for radio, right, Lucy? I mean, I'm a little follically challenged at the top. I don't wear a toupee, but I can identify with that when you said it. But nonetheless, the point being is that what we're probably dealing with is a fairly deep layer of thatch under that turf grass, because if you're able to pull up the turf grass, I love it is like a toupee, you're probably finding that you're pulling up both the plant and this jute rug looking stuff. That's thatch.
Yeah.
And so Kentucky bluegrass is a big thatch producer. And so now you got to think about, well, okay, first I need to get rid of thatch. Now, what I'm about to say is a long-term thing. The turf grass people out there, if they're listening, I don't want them to think I'm saying, okay, you're not trying to kill the grubs doing this. And it takes a while. Mm-hmm. If you continue to core aerate, so you're poking holes through that thatch, what you're doing is introducing oxygen to that organic layer. And research has shown
maybe about every 5 years or so.
I think I would shorten it.
This year.
I would shorten it. Yeah, I'd shorten it down to maybe every year if you could for a while.
Okay.
Because you're fighting, you know, the grubs are eating that thatch, what's bringing them in. So you're trying to reduce it. Now, if it gets totally out of hand and you're just saying, look, I've had enough, then you may want to strip off what you have. This is a major deal. Mm. You take off what you have, and then you plant what we call a bunch grass, like turf type tall fescue. The fescues are bunch grasses. They almost produce no thatch since they're not producing underground stems. We call rhizomes. So that's Kentucky bluegrass produces rhizomes that turns into thatch. Mm. So turf type tall fescue is less of a thatch producer. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to change the environment to be less favorable to the grubs. Now there are insecticide applications that were developed and tested very heavily by University of Kentucky, Dr. Dan Potter there, with a material called acelaprin that is very light on pollinators. It is a grub control product, but it does not affect pollinators. It doesn't affect if the bees are coming to clover, that sort of thing. But let's call those the big guns. Okay, let's hold that off.
Yeah.
I think I'd start with trying to slant away from my thatch producing turf grass.
Okay. Makes sense. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Hey, Jill, I've got a follow-up question to that. If she's core aerating, would you go back in with a fescue as the overseed with the aeration process and blend those, or would you?
No, that's an excellent point. Those species don't get along over time, John. I mean, eventually you'll get this bomb blast effect in your lawn with tall fescue looking like explosions because they are a bunch grass. And Kentucky bluegrass will not overtake them. So you'll get a very uneven looking lawn. We like to see people stick with the species. You can use mixed species, but over time they start segregating, and that's a pretty good point you're making. I honestly think, as I love Kentucky bluegrass, but it can produce thatch. And this is very important. I didn't say this to her. I should have. It mostly produces thatch when we over-fertilize, because you're stimulating a lot of production of those underground stems, the rhizomes. So again, to avoid thatch, if you have a Kentucky bluegrass lawn, pay close attention to not over-fertilizing.
Okay. Well, we have more questions. We won't be able to get to all of them. Very quick one for you, Mary. I don't know if you can do this in less than a minute. What's the best way to prepare my soil for dahlias, and what date is best to plant the tubers?
Ooh, so hopefully your dahlias have been stored properly and they were washed and they're dry and doing all their things. You want to wait to get in there until we have a little bit of a drier time, and then you want that consistent warm period. So I don't have a ton of personal experience with dahlias, but I would wait until we're after our frost-free date, which has been set at April 23rd this year. And so if you wait a few more days after that, again, just making sure that you're not compacting that soil. It's nice and fluffy for them. And you might want to put in your supports as well when you're planting them. You can also do that later. But if your dahlias are going to get big, and hopefully they do, just thinking about how you're going to support them long term.
And planting the tubers?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay. Great. Well, I've been talking with Assistant Entomology Professor at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher, and Civic Garden Center Director of Education Mary Dudley. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. It's been fun.
Yes. Thank you. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.